We are just coming out of Parshat Zachor, an annual reminder on the Shabbat before Purim for the need to take regular stock of where we are in our ongoing efforts to eradicate Amalek, a theme of Purim and the Megillah as well. We can interpret and possibly misinterpret this charge to remember and destroy Amalek in many different directions. And I will just note my colleague, Rabbi Ethan Tucker, Rosh Yeshivat Hadar, just wrote a piece that speaks to the nature of revenge and violence this particular year, especially. But today, for this time together, I invite us to focus on how the imperative of Zachor, of remembering Amalek, relates to the ongoing attention and work that it takes to confront sexual victimization in our communities, in our Torah, and in our world. As an invocation to frame our day, I want to share the words of a contemporary Israeli poet, Shulamit Halevi, herself a survivor of sexual victimization, as she draws upon imagery of Amalek and of Purim to cast the problem of sexual victimization in religious and really in theological terms. So first, a reminder of two images regarding the battle against Amalek from the Torah in Shemot and in the book of Devarim, which are sources 1 and 2, if you'd like to look on your source sheet, which is in the chat. One, we see in the book of Shemot that this is an ongoing war. And in cryptic language, it seems like God on God's throne takes some kind of oath to this effect. Confronting Amalek never ends. Number two, Amalek, we see in the book of Devarim in Deuteronomy, it represents an attack on the vulnerable, the people who are nechashalim, weak at the edge of the camp. And the Midrash that you see in source number 3 describes Amalek as somehow managing to penetrate the clouds of glory, the clouds of God that offered safety and security to the people in their desert wanderings. Amalek represents a moment, the moment of puncturing a sense of safety, exploiting a person's vulnerability, shattering their sense of dignity and safety. And that especially is the side of Amalek that I hope we can remember today. Shulamit Halevi, this is from her collection, Ot Hevel, a collection of poems written quite recently. This is the last poem in the book, the epilogue. She'asani kirtzono, who made me according to his will. Reach simun territoria zicharit yovetz al yad kesya. Zachur ki afar anachnu, karka olam. Hazidonot vashgagot atamakir, haratzon vehaones. The scent-marking male territory crouches next to the throne of God. He remembers that we are but dust, ground of the earth. Intentional versus unintentional, you discern. Will or desire versus coercion or rape. In Halevi's rendering, the war against Amalek represents the dangers of ongoing male dominance and violence, and this is encroaching upon the throne of God. In other words, a world in which there is an ongoing problem of sexual victimization poses a theological problem, a problem of theodicy. Where is God if we live in a reality in which sexual victimization is so common and widespread? The language of Zachor, remembering, is associated in this poem with being dust. And she draws on language from the Talmud that is used to describe Esther as, quote, ground of the earth, karka olam. In her poem, she brings us to the reality of so many people, especially women, who have been treated essentially like dirt. She draws upon the liturgical language of concession or confession. We are like dust, but turns the words into an accusation. Halevi speaks to the God who is aware of all of this, the God who knows the difference between consent and coercion. She turns to God as the one who knows every single time an act of sexual victimization has occurred. Every time a person's volition and self is trampled upon, when their vulnerability is taken advantage of and they are treated like dirt. Who is this God who knows all but does nothing? I read her words as an accusation in the form of a prayer. But her words also contain an expression not only of anger and frustration, but also of hope. The war against Amalek, based on this poem, need not be the image of ongoing violence. Instead, based on the Book of Devarim, it can be our ongoing need to confront those who exploit vulnerability. Each year, as the story of Esther approaches, Zachor, our Shabbat of remembering, and the aspect of Purim that is about remembering Amalek, becomes the ongoing imperative to notice, to address realities of sexual victimization, moments where someone's dignity is trampled upon. Each year we can, and each year we must, recommit ourselves to the work of building communities that are aware of potential vulnerability, and we can and we must double down on our efforts towards support, towards safety, and towards care. Her collection of poems is entitled Ot Hevel, the Mark of Abel, instead of the Mark of Cain, the Mark of Cain, which is actually what we find in the Torah. She invites us to imagine, what would it look like to live in a world where instead of perpetrators of violence being granted immunity like Cain, instead a victim or survivor would have the gift of special attention, even protection? What would Torah look like if it invited us into a world of Ot Hevel, the Mark of Abel, centering the experience of victims and survivors? The first session involves three teachers of Torah reflecting on the importance of an approach that aims to be responsible and responsive towards experiences of trauma and aspires to contribute to greater safety and healing in the process of teaching Torah. The second session is from the perspective of an expert in the field of addressing sexual victimization in communities who feels it is very important to ground that work in Torah and Jewish values. Our shared assumption is that Torah is powerful, but it is not automatically good or healing. Our sages teach that Torah can be a poison or an elixir of life, sam chaim or sam mavet. And our intentional approach to the way we study Torah makes all the difference. We are all here to seek out and amplify the Torah that brings life and healing. So I turn now to our first discussion between my dear colleagues, Rabbi Sarah Mulhern, the rabbi of Beis Lincoln in Chicago, and Rabbi Avi Killip, executive vice president at Hadar, and myself as Rosh Yeshiva at Hadar, and we will each reflect on Torah we have taught related to sexual victimization. To start our reflections on teaching, I'm going to share one text that jumped out at me when I was doing research for my dissertation, which was on the topic of sexual consent and coercion in the Talmud. This was back in 2017, when questions of leadership and sexual victimization were particularly on our minds in the United States. And I was searching for texts that complicated the very simple city versus field distinction that we find in the Torah related to criteria in the Torah for determining whether a sex act was consensual or coercive. In the Torah, if it was in the city, it's assumed to be consensual. Well, if it's in the field, it's considered to be coercion and an act of violence. Yet, we find a whole history of interpretation that makes this a little bit more complex. And in particular, especially as we approach the holiday of Purim, I wanted to bring a teaching that we find from a medieval sage, the Ritva, who characterized the entire kingdom of Ahasuerus as essentially a field. Ahasuerus and anyone like him who was a quote-unquote lover of woman, or we might say a womanizer, anyone in his kingdom who raped a woman didn't care about it. Lo ya makpid, he says. Therefore, anyone taken captive by Ahasuerus, the presumption is that the sex act occurred under coercion. The fact that they didn't scream is because there was no one to save them. And this sentence really jumped out at me in thinking about the importance of leadership in setting a tone of caring about sexual victimization. There can be cities, there could even be the capital of an empire, that are actually fields, because everything depends on culture. Will there be people who will respond if somebody calls out? Is there a culture that cares? Or is there no one? Is there a culture that does not pay attention and does not care? As I reflect today on teaching this text over the past number of years in many different settings, I am mostly struck by what it means to come from text and Torah, even this teaching, that in some ways is so powerful in identifying how there could be a field in what you think is a city, at the same time that text takes no responsibility. It's about Achashverosh. It's about a kingdom that belongs to others. But that source does not teach us what it looks like to rise to the challenge of taking responsibility for our own communities and to empower us to build communities that care. So my main question, from hearing many people's thoughts, comments on this teaching, how powerful it is, my main question for where we go is, what does it look like for Torah to not only offer us examples and language to name a culture that doesn't care, but to propel us forward into the work of building a culture that does care?
Hey, y'all. It's really nice to see a lot of familiar faces and some new faces. I want to use this short time to reflect a little, not only on a text, but on how I came to teach the text that I've brought and why and how I continue to teach it and related texts really for the last 5 years now. So I'm going to bring us back to what now feels like ancient history, October 15th, 2017. And suddenly hashtag Me Too starts blowing up on the internet. And without thinking about it much, I just kind of fire off a post, you know, Me Too. And within minutes, a colleague of mine replies saying he's seeing so many women post today, and he's really curious what definition of sexual harassment and assault we could all be using, because it can't be that so many of us have really experienced real sexual violence. I push back, and he argues a thing that I then began to hear many times in our community, which is that, you know, it has to be that many of us are jumping to conclusions, and that in doing so, we're violating the imperative of Dan Chassut. We're failing to give the benefit of the doubt to the people that we are imagining are harming us. So, okay, that interaction is obviously a myth for a whole host of reasons, and it deserves its own essay, and in fact, I wrote one. But for our purposes today, I'll just say that in addition to everything else about that moment, his comment was especially devastating to me, because Dan HaChatzut, this Jewish value of presuming the best of people, is actually something that I have a particular affinity for, something that I have especially cherished. My grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, taught me that if somebody cuts you off in traffic, you should take a deep breath and ask yourself how you'd feel about it if you knew that they were rushing to get to the hospital to be with a loved one. And I had been, at this point in time, several years involved in Usar Vad. And in that Vad, we had worked with Dan HaChatzut as a really crucial tool for reducing our own judgmentalism and hypocrisy. And so here was this really beloved idea being trotted out, not only by this man, but all over in Jewish communities and in the Jewish media, and being used as an excuse for not looking too closely at red flags, for papering over abuse, for putting folks in harm's way by handing out second chances to people who had not shown themselves worthy of those second chances. So I was blessed at that time to be sitting on a research team on gender and power at the Hartman Institute, which was led by my teacher, Dr. Alana Stein-Hain. And she encouraged me to take a deep dive into this concept of Dan HaChatzut in the rabbinic canon. And I really set out from a perspective of like wanting to know, like, what does this term mean and what does it not mean? And how did it come to have such a cultural force for Jews? And if I'm being honest, I really kind of wanted to arm myself up, right, so that I could make a claim about what it meant and what it looked like to use this idea responsibly from a place of rootedness in the tradition and also a place of awareness of our contemporary and human situation. And I'll be honest that I really, frankly, I expected to find a bunch of texts about how lovely and nice and important than the Chavkut was. And then to sort of have to put those texts on a source sheet with contemporary feminist critiques in order to open up this tension that I was feeling between what is truly so holy and important for healthy humans and healthy community about this idea, and also what is and was seeming more and more so to be frankly dangerous about it. I didn't expect to find what I did find, which was that we actually have a very rich tradition of texts that really struggle with what Dan Chavkut means and when we ought to push ourselves beyond comfort for the sake of trying to think well of others, and when we ought not to, and what the limits on that concept are, and when it is and isn't applicable, and who owes it, and when, and to whom, and under what circumstances. And I really did find myself surprised to find some authors and texts that were expanding the scope of the idea dramatically and others who were narrowing it almost out of existence. I wanted to share, I think, the one text that was probably the hardest for me to read in that research and also one of the most fascinating, the Mishnah in Avot, which teaches quite famously, Yoshua ben Parachi Omer, Asei Lecha Rav, Tnei Lecha Chaver, Vayu Dan et Kol Ha'adam Lechavkut, right? So without giving this text its full due, I just want to note two things. So first of all, in context, it seems like this is advice primarily for rabbis, right? Get yourself a teacher, get yourself a study partner. This seems to be for advice for rabbis and probably in the context of making legal rulings or halachic decisions in court. Two, this phrase, Have dan et kol adam l'chavkut, is like very opaque, right? It's difficult to know how to translate it. Here in general, the metaphor is, right, is of like the scales of justice, where one of the cups represents guilt and one represents innocence. And this advice seems to be like, take the innocence cup and use that one. And I, 5 years on, I still have no idea what the heck that means. There's some kind of emphasis on the innocence or presumption of the innocence or weight towards the innocence. Not entirely clear. And like many times where there are concepts that are slippery, I think it's important to notice that the Talmud here doesn't really attempt to define them as food. It just like throws a series of stories at us that kind of point us in the direction of understanding. And again, we don't have time in this context to do the kind of close reading that this really rich and layered story deserves. But you have it, you should read it. I'd love to learn it that way together. For now, I'm just going to summarize this Gemara and offer like a few of my high-level noticings. So the structure of the Sugya is as follows. We have this introductory headline, a person who judges their fellow favorably will be judged favorably. And then we have three stories. So the first story is by far the most detailed one. It's a story of a wealthy master who engages in what very much looks like labor abuse of a vulnerable employee. And we're given a lot of details about the ways in which he seems to screw over his employee. And we're sort of let into the inner world of the worker and how much he suffers. And then we're sort of shown this like weird quiz in which the employer swoops in, rectifies some of the harm that he did, and then asks his worker like, hey, what did you think of me at each stage in this process? And the worker professes that he thought the best of his employer all the way through, even as it becomes sort of increasingly hard to construct stories that make the boss look good and also fit the evidence of what he did. The employer confirms, yes, all your positive takes were in fact correct, and offers the employee this blessing that God will judge the employee as favorably as he judged his employer. Okay, story two. A pious man is rescuing a young Jewish woman from captivity. On the way back, they stay over at an inn, and he has her, quote, lie beneath his feet, which is a common biblical and rabbinic euphemism for sex. But basically, it seems like they share a bed or maybe even a room behind closed doors. And his students apparently observe this happening. And in the morning, the man goes to the mikveh, which in the rabbinic period, men did after ejaculating, before teaching his students. And then he engages his students in a quiz, much like the one in the previous story. What did you think of me at this stage? What did you think of me at this stage of this like very suspicious looking behavior? Again, they claim that they thought only good of him. The rabbi reveals that all their positive assumptions were correct and offers them the same blessing. So I'll break the flow of the sugi here to say that there are at least three really interesting differences between these two stories. So first of all, in the second story, the quizzing and the expectation of positive judgment is not directed at the apparent victim, but at the students who observe the troubling behavior. Two, unlike in the first story where you get this really powerful look at the inner life of the suffering of the worker, we have no idea what this young woman, who's already returning from this highly vulnerable state of captivity, felt or thought when the rabbi took her into his bed, right? Was she relieved? Was she panicked? We have no idea because she's not a character, right? We don't hear her voice. Third, in this case, and I think this is really fascinating, in order to cast their rabbi in a positive light, the students are pushed or maybe even forced to cast aspersions on each other or on themselves, and they imply that perhaps the rabbi took her into his room to protect her from the possibility that one of them would rape her. Okay, the final story proceeds along this now familiar pattern with the striking difference that in the third version of the story, the woman is actually a powerful and sexualized Roman matron, rather than the concern, the appearance being that the rabbi was taking advantage of this vulnerable young woman. It looks as if the rabbi is putting himself into a circumstance to be taken advantage of by her in order to gain some kind of political protection for the Jewish community. But again, we have this quizzing of the students and the finding out that the students only thought the best of their teacher and the assurances that they were correct and the blessing. Okay, so a few like high-level points about this whole sugya. So first of all, at this point in our discussion, like Dan Lechavtzlut is definitely not advice for judges making legal decisions anymore, right? It's for everyone all the time. And I think really importantly, it seems to be something that high-status people are demanding from low-status people over whom they have a direct and large amount of power, right? Bosses over their workers, teachers over their students. And it's something that people ask from the people that they directly harmed or from the immediate bystanders who might be impacted or disillusioned by their behavior, and not just from like society at large. And it's not just a simple matter of like sort of a presumption of innocence, but it's actually asking someone else to do the hard work of constructing the best possible story about your seemingly bad behavior that can hold the data points they observed, no matter how unlikely. Also, I think important to note that it doesn't seem to be something that's like required of everybody as a baseline. It's like a kind of virtuous practice that earns a blessing. So here, the main thing that I really struggle with about this text is that on the surface, these stories are clearly stories in praise of behaving with Dan Lechavtzlut, but I read them and I find them to be like quite surfacing of complexities and like quite dark. And so my big question 5 years into sitting with this text is like, is that darkness really a part of the story itself? Is it an intentional undercurrent pointing to sort of underneath the beauties? Here are also some of the dangers and complexities that later rabbinic texts do come and explore. Or is it something that like I'm overlaying onto the text because of the particular questions I'm bringing to it? And like, does that matter? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. So I'll end by just saying a few things about how I teach this text. First, it's important for me to say that I never teach this text without sharing that I am someone who has experienced sexual violence. And it's important for me to do that because I want to be honest with my students about some of the experiences that are shaping the person who I am when I read it, and therefore how I read it. And also because I want my students, whether or not they have shared those experiences, to have some sense that as like genuinely fascinating a sort of legal and intellectual question that exists about when and how and to whom to give benefit of the doubt, there's also like real stakes for me and for others who've experienced this kind of harm, and therefore for every single member of our community in terms of how we choose as a culture to understand and deploy this idea. And within that, I also always assume that I'm not the only person in the room who has experienced sexual violence. I developed a practice actually of praying before I taught this material that I would have the ability to teach it without causing harm, because that's kind of like how high stakes it feels to me. And I try to be really explicit about letting my students know, like, I'm going to be here to the best of my ability to hold you during this class, after this class. I try not to teach without like providing space after for people to approach me. Even if it's just like sharing my email on the first sheet, which I've done today, so that people can follow up. And I'll say that almost every time I've taught this material, someone has come forward to share with me what it meant for them to learn it as someone who has experienced gender-based violence, or to share about a time that they've had to make real decisions about these issues as a leader in the Jewish community. I'll say one other thing, which is that one area where my friend and teacher Gila, who you'll have the chance to learn with later, has really pushed me, is that despite all of what I just said, I wasn't always teaching these texts in a really victim-centered way. And then I originally got very caught up in my questions about the ethics of how to treat people who look like they might be perpetrating harm and the sort of like Jewish public policy implications. And I didn't give enough emphasis to the question of like, what was the experience of the worker? What are the experiences of the woman, of the young woman captive? And like interrogating sort of like, why are those perspectives here or not here? And what does that mean for the stories that do and don't get told in our community? So I'm very indebted to her for pushing me on this. And I'll just say, for me, it really comes down to this, which is that as long as people are using Torah, and in particular, this specific concept of Torah to perpetrate harm, as they do when they silence people or protect perpetrators, or won't investigate concerning behavior because they think they need to uphold this value of demachasput. So as long as that's happening, then it seems obvious to me that like part of the work of healing from that harm and building future safety is going to have to happen through that same Torah. And since like I happen to have some skills as a teacher of Torah, like that's my piece of the work. And so I think it's really crucial for me when I teach this text that I try to like always stay centered in the fact that it's like really not a matter of theory, but in fact, like the assumption is that I'm actually engaging my students and preparing my students for like real conversations when these issues are going to come up in their communities. And that like in doing that, we are sort of actively participating in shifting our own culture through this learning and teaching and writing of Torah in real time to make a different culture of Torah.
Thank you so much for this initial, I know, tip of the iceberg sense of some of the teaching that you've been doing and how you approach it. It's really quite poignant. I'm going to turn the mic now to Rabbi Avi Killip, and then we'll all have a chance to share and discuss together.
Thank you. Just want to thank Rav Aviva and Rav Sarah. It's like I can feel my own heart rate races a little bit faster when I hear you teach these texts. So I just want to also thank everyone for taking time this morning to not look away from them. I want to share an unconventional text, which is a midrash from a collection called Dirshuni, which is a collection of modern Israeli women's midrash. So they came out in the last decade. There's two volumes. They are edited by a scholar named Tamar Biala. And the midrash that I want to share is written by a woman named Rivka Luvich, who is actually by day an activist lawyer, not a scholar. And I think you'll feel that and hear that come through in the midrash. She actually spends her days defending women in the Israeli courts, and obviously trying to grapple with really big and significant questions. And one of the ways she has come to grapple is by writing midrash, and writing the midrash that I'm going to read and share today. I want to share this midrash. I want to just sort of like name what I'd like to highlight from the beginning so you can listen for it. The first is just that our holy texts contain harmful stories. You know, this is version 3 you're getting of that. So we're not looking away from that or hiding that or pretending that that isn't true. And number 2 is I think this midrash in particular helps us think about how can we step up to participate in this conversation. We women, we victims, we modern people, that this is not just texts that we inherit, but we also get to figure out how we want to teach them and how we want to interact with them. And this midrash is a great example of that. So we're going to read a short midrash that is based in the story of Bat Yiftach from the Book of Judges, which you may or may not be familiar with. It is up there with one of the most troubling texts in our Tanakh, in our Bible. Yiftach is a general, and he is in the throes of war, and he makes a vow. If we win this battle, when I come home, I will offer as a sacrifice the first thing that walks out of my home, that greets me when I get home. He comes home. He wins. He comes home. And the first thing that greets him out of the house is his daughter. Now, here's where the story goes off the rails, right? Because what he should say is, hey, daughter, come stand next to me and let's watch to see what comes out of the house that we're going to offer. Because it should not even occur to him that you can sacrifice your daughter. But that's not what he does. He takes this understanding that what came out of his house first is his daughter, and that to fulfill his vow, he has to actually sacrifice his daughter, and he decides that's what he's going to do. And his daughter asks for a few months. Can she go into the woods for a few months with her friends? And he grants this, and she does this, and then she comes back, and when she returns home, she's killed. So the first text that I have on the page here is just to ground us in a little bit of the story from Judges. After 2 months' time, she returned to her father, and he did to her as he had vowed. She had never known a man. So it became a custom in Israel for the maidens of Israel to go every year for 4 days in the year and chant dirges for the daughter of Yiftach, the Gileadite. So she comes back, she's killed. He kills her, I suppose, in this more active way. And the Benot Israel, the women of Israel, the maidens of Israel, create this sort of like holiday festival memorial where they go off into the woods for 4 days every year, Litanot Labat Yiftach, to wail, to chant dirges, to cry for Bat Yiftach. That's the text that we have here. And that's the text that Rivka Luvich is going to draw on. What I want to do is read them. I'm going to read the whole Midrash through because it's very short. And then I'm going to come back through and highlight a couple points that I want us to see. So the first time you'll just be able to hear what she's doing. So if it doesn't make sense to you, I'll explain how the Midrash is working in just a second. The Shechina said to Yiftach's daughter, to Bat Yiftach, Yiftach had no progeny from you. And on earth, they don't know that a woman has a name of her own, even without having a son or daughter. Sit with me in heaven and weep for this. On earth, they call you Bat Yiftach, the daughter of Yiftach. I will call you Tanot. Why was she called Tanot? Because it is written, and so since long ago, the daughters of Israel go to wail, Letanot, for the daughter of Yiftach the Gileadite, 4 days a year. And they said, Tanot does not mean wailing, but it is the name of Yiftach's daughter. And what does she do? She sits in heaven and listens to the stories of the earthly daughters of Israel, and then sits by the Shechina and bewails their sorrows in her ear, prays for them, and pleads their righteousness. So what's happening in this Midrash? The first thing I want to point out is literally the first thing, is that the Shechina is speaking to Bat Yiftach, right? So in terms of like, what lessons can we take? If Bat Yiftach is the ultimate victim here, right? The first thing to know is that God, the Shechina here is the female name for God that we're using. God speaks directly to Bat Yiftach, right? She's not a side character. She's not unimportant. She's worthy of God speaking directly to her. So I feel like this opening is already healing and a corrective on this story, right? We look at the story and we say, where is God? And this Midrash tells us God is speaking directly to her. That's step one. And God notices something, which is that she doesn't have a name, right? She's just called the daughter of Yiftach. And that is bad enough, right? We say, actually, women are real and they are themselves and they have names, whether or not they've had children, right? Whether or not you've had sex with someone else, like you exist and you have a name and that's important. But there's something worse happening actually to Bat Yiftach, which is that she's known by her father's name and her father is actually the victimizer here. He's actually the one causing harm. So she's actually known here by the name of the perpetrator. And that also in our lives is all too common, right? Rav Sarah was talking about victim-centered versus perpetrator-centered. When we refer to women as, you know, the victims of Jeffrey Epstein or the victims of Harvey Weinstein or whatever the local example would be, we're not only not referring to them by name, we're actually referring to their identities become subsumed in who is the perpetrator. That's what happens to Bat Yiftach here. And God says, we're going to give you a name, okay? And this is a beautiful textual read. Here's how the name works. The verse that we read is the women go to weep for Bat Yiftach, litanot lebat Yiftach. But the midrashic, extremely close reading of this text is that she makes it into sort of like an epithet. Oh, this is her name, to litanot, comma, lebat Yiftach, right? Thank you to Rav Aviva, comma, to the one who opened up this session, right? That Tanot becomes not just the thing we're doing, but actually her name becomes Tanot. So Tanot is not a normal name, right? If I was like, let's all come up with a name for Bat Yiftach, you would not generate the name Tanot, because Tanot is not really a name. But the brilliance of this midrashic reading is that she doesn't give her a name out of nowhere. We give her a name directly from the text. We find the answer, we find the corrective directly in the source and directly in the text, which is extremely powerful. The other thing that's extremely powerful about her name is that her name means weeping, right? So this is also a reclaiming of what does weeping mean? What, you know, instead of like weeping as a disempowering thing. Oh, women who cry all the time. It's like, oh, you were a victim. Are you just going to sit at home and cry all the time? It's like, no, actually her strength and her power comes from her weeping. Her name is Tanot. Those things are connected. And it sort of reshapes for us, what does weeping mean in general? So that's how this midrash works. And then there's this last very powerful thing that she's given, not just a name, she's given a job. She's given a role. What does she do? She sits in heaven and listens to the stories of the earthly daughters of Israel. And then she sits by the Shekhinah and bewails their sorrows in her ear, prays for them and pleads their righteousness. So she has a job. First of all, this is an image that seems familiar to us maybe from the High Holidays, right? From the idea that we have advocates up in heaven who are advocating for us. You know, it's not like a made up image. It's lifted from somewhere. But this is different because she is listening So first of all, she comes to sit with God. God says, come sit with me. Not only does God speak to her directly, God invites her in. It's like a God that is close to the brokenhearted, right? Actually, this experience of becoming victim has brought her closer to God, which is something that can happen. And the other thing is that what is something that we sometimes see, not always, but one way that people who are feel stuck in this victim category, and that's not the identity they want, one way out of that is that they become activists, right? They listen to other stories and they advocate on behalf of others. And this is a biblical theological version of that, right? This character who is the most victimized and has no other identity is now the activist who listens to our stories and advocates on our behalf. That's really powerful. The last thing I'll say here, I like to say Dirshuni Midrashim refuse to stay on the page, right? Is that we are in this Midrash because we are Benoit Yisrael. Right? And what Tanot does is she listens to Banot Yisrael and advocates. And in this way, this midrash is not just like a nice, cute reading of the story or, you know, it actually changes our experience of our religion because we now have Tanot, a place that we can go to, an ear that is listening, someone we can call out to. So I just want to conclude by sharing that Tamar Biala, who is the editor of these midrashim, talked about how in her family, this midrash appeared in the first collection of Dirshuni. There's then a second collection that came out years later, that Tamar Biala, in her family, Tanot became a character. When they heard a horrible story, when they read a horrible news article, and they said, like, I don't know how to hold this or where to put this or how to process this. They said, this is a story for Tanot. Tanot, you need to hear this. You need to read this. That was the way that they started to call out. Bring this directly to God. Bring this directly to the Shekhinah. And in that way, Tanot became a character in their family and in their lives. I put a second midrash in the handout here, which we're not going to look at actually at all right now, but I wanted to offer it to you as a gift. It's another modern midrash on this theme, but I just want to share with you. You can see the verses at the top. This one is written by Tamar Biala. It is a response to some other problematic sexual victimization imagery in Yechezkel in Ezekiel. And she starts her midrash this way. Tanot asked the Shekhinah, what did Yechezkel say that contradicted the Torah? She starts her midrash with the character of Tanot and God, the Shekhinah, having a conversation. And that the fact of this character Tanot not only allowed her family to ask questions, but it then spurred further Torah, right? More Torah about this question, that we know, not only do we feel like we're not alone because we can ask our questions to Tanot, we can bring our problems to Tanot, but we're not alone. We're down here having this earthly version of this conversation, grappling with difficult text. And Tanot and the Shekhinah are like up there in heaven,
or wherever you think the Shamayim is, they're having a theological, you know, cosmic version of this same question. And we're just doing this earthly version of that same conversation that's happening there. And then you can read this other beautiful midrash much longer that Tamar put, so I won't go into it. I share this text by way of a hope that we can find ways into the conversation, find ways to look directly at the stories and yet figure out how to turn them into real healing in the same way that without doing this work, they can do real harm.
Thank you so much. Powerful teaching. And I think it feels so incredible to have these three little tastes, but also very different perspectives here this morning, and looking at sort of classical passage in the Talmud that is about sexual victimization and asking how something that looks like a city could actually be a field. How do we build a culture that cares? I'm looking at the complexity of down the kaf schut, judging people favorably, the dangers of how that can actually be used to suppress responses to problematic behavior. And finally, it's contemporary women's midrash, reclaiming name, voice, self, agency, through the process of creative midrash. But my question for all of us is, as teachers of Torah, and really as teachers of all kinds of Torah, why does it feel important to you to surface this Torah? Why do you find it is important to bring it into conversation with a larger cultural conversation about sexual violence?
I already spoke a little bit about the ways in which, you know, the Torah concept that I'm working with here, among others, is actively used in Jewish communities today to create harm. So obviously, given that, putting a better version of that idea and deeper wisdom about when and how to use it responsibly out into our culture feels like a really important part of changing that. And clearly, you know, an important work of just having there be one less excuse for neglecting to investigate potentially dangerous behavior is like a step towards safer communities. But I think that I want to say it actually sharper, which is that when we don't do that, victims or potential victims are being incorrectly, but being told that there is a direct conflict between their safety and their dignity and this Jewish virtue. And what you're basically telling folks when you don't do this work is that you should stop caring either about yourself or about Torah. So I think the work of helping people see that that's a lie and that we are entitled and actually required to care about both ourselves and Torah is like a deeply healing project. And I also think, and this is a big piece of why I find Dershuni and Rav Avi's teaching so moving, which is that for those of us who are women and or people who have experienced sexual violence and rabbis or teachers of Torah, that list of identities and roles just like didn't overlap that much before in human history. And so there's like a special opportunity and responsibility to contribute to growing Torah in a healthier direction by like making sure that our voices and our Torah enter the canon. So like, yeah, I would love to like only get to teach Torah about like how to build a sukkah and like Parshat Lech Lecha. And I do a lot of that. And also like, this is a crucial piece of like what I specifically can really add to Torah. Like, you know, as much as if in every other way, they're like greater Torah producers than me. Like this is something I can bring that like Rashi and Rav Yosef Karo couldn't. And like Torah needs me and like needs us in this area. I think a lot about a conversation I had with my colleague and friend, Rabbi Elizabeth Bonnie Cohen, who shared with me a like common sort of teaching wisdom that is so important in this area that like we need to learn how to teach from things that are not wounds, but scars, and like how to teach safely from these kinds of experiences once they're scars and not wounds. But also like, what is it to like really step up to the responsibility that like our scars actually demand of us a certain Torah and a certain teaching. So that's already a lot. I'll just say one more quick thing, which is that despite the kind of like flat, dumb way that Dan Chaskut often gets talked about, I actually think that like the post-Talmudic conversation about it is like really complex and often quite aware of the things that can go wrong in the use of the idea. And actually, I think that like a lot of the classical texts are actually having much smarter conversations about when and when not to use these ideas, a much more robust conversation than the sort of like default American and default American Jewish ones that we have been having. And so they're certainly missing some voices, including like mine and ours. But I actually do think that in a lot of ways, we can learn a tremendous amount about how to have these conversations better by learning this Torah.
I give two answers. The first answer is because it's here. Like, why teach this Torah? Because it's here. And to not teach it is to ignore it. I think that's both that the texts are here and the themes are here in the text. And even just in a short pre-conversation that the three of us had, realization of like how many different things we could teach that feel directly on this topic. You don't have to like make it up in order to find it. And the second is that the people are here, right? There are people in the room who have this as a lived experience, and to not teach on it would be to ignore their lived experience. I want to also offer like just a really personal answer, which is like just really to go for the heart of it, which is to talk about like what am I doing as a rabbi, but also as a spiritual person myself and as a spiritual seeker myself, which is that I feel like I am in search. This is language that I've only come to recently, but I feel like it's a journey I've been on. I'm in search of a God who knows women, of a relationship with a God who actually knows and understands the experiences of women. And when I find Torah like the Torah that the two of you taught and the Torah of this Midrash that I shared, it actually brings me closer to God when I have that experience, because it allows me to understand a God that actually cares and hears about these experiences. And then all of mitzvot and all of my Jewish life actually is richer, because that allows all of mitzvot become my journey to become closer to that God. And so I feel like it's nothing short of like actually crucial to my theology to engage with and think about these questions.
Thank you. I love getting to hear your thoughts, both of you. It's really powerful and moving. And I will share, I'm sometimes conflicted about teaching some of this, especially a lot of my sort of research and learning has been in the area of classical texts. And I think like you mentioned, Rav Sarah, Dr. Gila Menchmal, who we'll hear from later, I think always sort of pushes us to ask, is the experience of people who have experienced sexual victimization at the center or on the margins of the teaching? And I do sometimes wonder if kind of coming to this material is actually what people need or want to hear to heal in Torah, or if there are just other parts of Torah about other things that are very important for that healing process. And so I do think that the Dirshuni Midrash collection, and I brought that poem by Shulamit Halevi, the people who are turning to Torah from this experience and asking what can Torah offer me feels like such a huge piece. And at the same time, I do think it's really important to teach some of these sources, because they can really expose like blind spots in the Jewish community and how we approach Torah and our community. I to me, like taking Shulamit Halevi's poem and teaching it in a Yom Iyun, a sort of day of study about God, comes out of talking with a number of different people and students who've approached me after kind of teaching or just in conversation and shared some of their story and kind of profound religious questions that emerge out of their own experience of sexual violence, or knowing that it can be so widespread that that's not just a sort of conversation that happens for a particular subset of people who've had a certain experience. And that becomes a much larger theological question that sort of anybody who wants to be in a relationship with God needs to understand, that this is the piece of that. And there are unresolved questions here and there is work to be done. So I do think that that sort of bringing some of these sources to light can be important, but can sometimes operate on two different planes. And it's really important to be aware of those two different planes, right? What is important for a larger community to hear, people who may not be so aware of realities of sexual victimization, to become more aware of what is at stake. And that may or may not overlap with the kind of Torah that needs to be there for people who are trying to heal from their own experience. One question that came anonymously, it was a question of, the Ahasuerus text is focused on Ahasuerus has a reputation as a womanizer. And what do we do when actually people who are in much sort of more honored positions and have a good reputation, quote unquote, are that's where stories are emerging, and it can be harder for community to take those stories seriously. And how do we make sure that people who are coming forward are being heard and also protect the rights of the accused? So I wanted to have us share thoughts on that for a minute. I will just say, as the teacher of that text about Ahasuerus, what I think is so important about that text is it's not only about Ahasuerus. It's about the culture and tone that is set throughout his entire empire, which makes it very hard for anyone, even perhaps a generally well-intentioned person, to act out of a position of sort of caring about the impact of their actions, because the tone just hasn't been set, right? So I think one thing that is critical there is, instead of kind of looking at isolated individuals, and though obviously every individual is accountable for their actions, there's a larger question around communities and the sort of education and culture that we have, so that well-intentioned people can actually know more about the impact of their actions. But I'm going to turn it over to the two of you as well to speak about that particular question. What about reputations, their stories coming out? How do we listen and protect the rights of the accused?
I think that, you know, there's a really troubling text from the Rambam where he says that, like, Dam Chatzlut is only operative for people who you don't know what their reputation is. Like, if the reputation of a person is already bad, even if their behavior seems to be good, you ought to imagine and assume that it's bad. And if a reputation of a person is already good, you ought to assume that it continues to be good, even if their behavior is not looking so great. And I find that text really, really challenging, because I think there's, like, a real insight in it, which is, like, of course, our previous experiences of people, like, will impact how we read any given behavior of those people. And of course, you know, people that we have long-term trusting relationships and perceptions of as, like, good people, we read them differently than we read people that we don't have data on, or people that we have negative experiences with. And that, like, makes sense. And that text taught irresponsibly is, like, totally destructive, because it's just saying, like, well, if Rabbi so-and-so has always had a good reputation, you ought to just ignore all the evidence of your eyes that makes it look like he might be perpetrating harm. And so I think, you know, the answer is maybe that we need to write, like, a new text that is in conversation with what the Rambam has written, and, like, tries to hold the insight and tries to say, like, no, actually, like, we have to act to prevent harm. No matter what, we have to act to prevent harm. And in some ways that text, like, is actually already available in the form of the Chofetz Chaim, who says this, like, really mind-blowing and beautiful thing, which is that if you hear a rumor that someone is perpetrating harm, you actually ought not to believe that rumor, like, in your heart of hearts, and still act to prevent harm, which I think is, like, a really challenging and unclear how it would work, but also, like, beautiful way forward, which is, like, in my heart, I have to hold the possibility that you're still the good person I thought you were, and I am not excused from the responsibility to act to prevent the harm that it seems like you might be doing.
Thank you. I will have us, you can respond to that if you like, but I also want to give a prompt in our closing minute here. There's questions here about how to get through chapters 1 and 2 in the Megillah and the beauty contest. And if anybody wants to weigh in on that question, that would be great as well.
I'll say what I was going to say, and maybe it applies also to this, which is that I think another thing that text study teaches us, and again, the Midrash that I did not read speaks to this directly, but it's just the concept that texts can be both holy and harmful. And we are left to grapple with that. And I'll just say the same can be true of people, like, right? People are not either good or bad. purely. And sometimes when we are grappling with like, but I, you know, but this person has a great reputation, but also I'm being told these bad things. And how do I hold both of those? Is to be able to say like, well, they may be holy and harmful simultaneously. And we have to relate to the harm from a perspective of protecting victims. But that we as Jews, I think, and the study of these difficult texts in the Torah, like force us to try to figure out how to hold something as both holy and harmful, and then figure out how to protect ourselves, which is the most important thing, but also not fall into an assumption that like, well, if this negative thing that I heard about you is true, you know, you suddenly become entirely worthless as a human being and nothing else that you ever did mattered. And our relationship is completely flattened, that you could say this piece of Yechezkel is the center of my religion and also extremely harmful. And I want to have to find a way to acknowledge both of those things. And maybe that's true of the Megillah also.
I'll just add one more thing. So first of all, I don't know why my internet went down. So sorry, I'm just by phone at this moment, which is like, I actually think that the whole story of Megillat Esther is so much more powerful if we're honest about the fact that Esther was sexually trafficked and that like, even in the context of so much harm that she has personally experienced, she is able to like rise up as a leader and a hero who saves other people. Like that to me is like a really moving story. And like, I don't know exactly, Rafi, how you tell that story to your five-year-old. I'm worrying about the same thing with my six-year-old. But like, what does it mean to be like, yeah, Esther is one of us. She is a victim and she is strong and she is a hero and she saved the Jewish people.
Coming back to these texts year after year in the process of Talmud Torah can be part of ongoing growing awareness, not only about the text, but about the world around us. And so in that way, it might not be that everything can be taught to the five-year-old daughter, and the practice of coming back to Megillah year after year in community may be part of an ongoing process of learning about the text and about the world around us.